Wisconsin Eye is in Milwaukee at the State Republican Convention, visiting once again with the Dean of Wisconsin's Congressional Delegation, Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner. Jim, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thanks, Steve. Good to see you again.
I want to draw on your experience of Washington and how it works. I want to get your ideas of how the Mueller investigation it potentially could end and when. What are your thoughts, sir?
Well, I was the one that allowed the Ken Starr law to expire in 2003. Independent counsels or special counsels, they have no budget. They are not limited to what they were created to investigate, and they keep on rolling on and on like Old Man River. Mueller is like Ken Starr, you know, and he's gone far afield from looking at alleged Russian interference in the presidential election. And I don't think that it's healthy to have the executive branch, regardless of whether there's a Republican or Democrat, sitting in the White House under a perpetual cloud with one of these special or independent counsels. You know, I think that if there is no interference, that Mueller can end up proving in court. You know, he ought to say, I've done an investigation, I found nothing, and shut down his investigation. But he's got an unlimited budget. And he says when the investigation is shut down, no matter what he is looking into. Judge Ellis in Alexandria, I think, hit the nail on the head, saying, why is Manafort indicted when we don't know what the charge of the independent counsel is?
So it's going to go, unfortunately, on and on with no foreseeable end, sir?
Well, it's up to Mueller to decide when there's an end, and nobody else, not the Justice Department, not the president, not the Congress. He is an independent a person, and he decides what to investigate. He decides when he's done, and not until he decides when he's done is he done. Now, I don't know if it was Casey Stengel or Yogi Berra said it ain't over till it's over. Well, it's Robert Mueller that says it ain't over till it's over.
Do you believe the president when he says no collusion witch hunt?
There hasn't been any evidence that Mueller has come up with and has been leaked out to the news media showing any type of collusion. And that independent counsel shop and most of the assistants helping Mueller out, you know, have been big Democrats, and a lot of them have contributed a lot of money to Hillary Clinton's campaign. You know, yeah, I think the president is right. You know, the thing is Mueller ought to be told, if there is collusion, go to a grand jury, get an indictment, and if there is no evidence to obtain an indictment, then fold your tent.
Do you think we're on the verge of a constitutional crisis if there is a subpoena issued for the President of the United States, Congressman?
No, I don't think so. Whether or not the subpoena is valid will end up going to the Supreme Court on whether the President can be subpoenaed. You know, I would point out that Bill Clinton, during the Starr investigation, voluntarily appeared before the grand jury, and two of the articles of impeachment were as a result of the testimony that he gave to the grand jury. But that was a voluntary appearance. It was not a result of a subpoena that was issued by Mr. Starr.
If the president asked your advice as a veteran attorney, former chairman of House Judiciary, should he talk to Mr. Mueller? How would you advise him?
Well, it depends upon what he knows and what he thinks Mueller's questions will be. And the only way an attorney can properly advise the president on that is the president giving the attorney, under the attorney-client privilege, all of the information that he needs to know to properly and vigorously represent him. But that isn't the case just with Donald Trump. You know, that's the case with everybody who gets a subpoena to appear in some type of a grand jury or criminal or John Doe investigation.
You've watched President Trump for 17 months. You've also watched X number of presidents. What has he done best? What has he done not so well, Congressman?
Well, I think the best thing that he has done, in my opinion, you know, is to reverse the regulatory state and help push through the tax cut. Because America is prosperous now. Unemployment's down. Minority unemployment is at the lowest level since records were being kept. Collections by the IRS are up because people are making more money and more of them are on the payroll. And I would say the second best thing that he's done is negotiating the North Koreans to the table. That's something that none of his predecessors were able to do. And I believe that there is a chance that we could get a disarmed nuclear North Korea, provided that there is a very transparent, effective, and vigorous inspection system, just like Reagan and Gorbachev negotiated when they got rid of the intermediate-range missiles in Europe on both sides.
And how has the president's leadership disappointed you, sir?
Well, I think the president's leadership has disappointed me is that he tweets a little too much, real or perceived personal slights. And if he spent his time tweeting on issues and policies and how he wants to direct the country, I think that he would be a lot better off and the country would also be a lot better off. So it's kind of putting the filter on the Twitter.
Has a constant churn in the White House of senior staffers hurt his ability to be president?
I don't think so. I think the ability to be president is based upon people in your cabinet and in the White House staff that the president has absolute confidence in. And you got to remember that he didn't expect to win, and I don't think many of us expected him to win. So he had to put together an administration and a White House staff literally at the blink of an eye, you know, to get them through all of the security clearances, and some of them didn't make it through there, to be able to set things up. And he had a year to figure out who was working in the way that he wanted them to work and who wasn't. And I think the ones that were not are those that have been replaced with people that he has a lot more confidence in rather than right after the election where he really had to shoot blind.
Some of the special elections and the way they've turned out, do you see what's been called a blue wave coming that doesn't favor your party, Congressman?
Well, you know, what I can say is special elections are frequently anomalies because both parties can concentrate their money and concentrate their message. And special elections historically have favored the party that is not in the White House. That's not the case necessarily in a general election where you have all of the seats in the House, a third of the Senate, and a good share of the governors. What worries me is the enthusiasm gap, because the Marquette poll, and this is confirmed by polls in other states and national polls, show that the Democrats are much more enthusiastic than the Republicans are about the midterm elections. Now, that really is not surprising, because people who are angry are more enthusiastic about changing things, and people who aren't angry, and given the fact that the Republicans control everything both nationally and here in Wisconsin, they're inclined to say, well, you know, things are fine and we don't have to get our blood pressure up. The fact is that midterm elections are decided based upon enthusiasm and turnout. And Republicans run the risk of losing everything here in Wisconsin if the Republicans decide to sit back and enjoy life because life is going good and the country and the states are doing well.
You sound worried that your party could lose the U.S. House.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that we lose the U.S. House. However, how a party does both in midterm and presidential elections is dependent upon two things, presidential approval rating and the so-called generic ballot. Trump's approval rating has been going up since the first of the year, and we haven't had any real good polling since the breakthrough on North Korea. The generic ballot is going up for Republicans as well. Trump is still underwater, so are the Republicans in the generic ballot, we still have got almost 6 months to go before the election, and 6 months is a century in terms of political and public opinion.
Trump defenders like Kellyanne Conway and Anthony Scaramucci say, news media, you don't get it. The American people care more about the booming economy and progress in international relations, including North Korea. Is that what you're hearing from residents of your district?
Well, you know, absolutely. And, you know, I can say that the, you know, the mainstream news media, I think, is losing credibility, losing ratings, losing listenership, and losing print media circulation. what has replaced that is a source of news. Is not necessarily the best, because people watch the TV channels on cable that they like. Fox News if you're Republican and conservative, MSNBC if you're Democrat and liberal. So the problem that we have, and I mention this when I talk about what's wrong with politics, is that a lot of people don't respect opposing opinions. They ought to respect opposing opinions and listen to them, because if you listen to opposing opinions, you can be a much better advocate for your point of view.
One issue that I haven't had a chance to ask you about is Russian interference with Russian bots. Did the Russian bots influence votes in the 2016 election?
I don't think so. I've yet to run into the first person who changed their vote from Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump because it would make Putin happy. And every once in a while, when I hear about Russian bots or Russian interference or what Russians have snuck on social media, either with the knowing or not knowing of the folks who control and own the social media, sometimes I ask people to raise their hand. I haven't found anybody that changed their vote from Clinton to Trump because it made Putin happy. I would invite any listener of Wisconsin Eye who feels that way to call my office or to send me an email saying that the Russians caused me to change my vote in 2016.
Were you surprised at the extensive now data on Russian interference, or did you think that had been going on for X number of years?
They've been doing it forever, including during Soviet days. The Soviets hated Reagan, and they even met with Ted Kennedy back in the day to try to figure out a way to defeat Reagan. So this isn't anything that's new, and the Russians have been involved in the French election, the Brexit vote, the German election, probably a lot more that hasn't gotten the publicity. So, this is an undemocratic state that tries to use its power to influence how people think in democratic countries.
What's your advice for voters across the nation in terms of being sure they're not reading Russian bots as we lead up to the November 6th election?
Well, look at how the candidates stand, and if the candidate's platform and voting record, if an incumbent is running for re-election, mostly agrees with what you'd like to see the state or country go, don't listen to any advertising that goes up. Just go out and vote for the person who will best represent your views. That's the way I think that politics and elections should be decided. What was most disappointing to me about a decade ago is that 94% of the voters cast their votes on factors other than how a candidate stood. And, no wonder why people end up being surprised when they thought they were voting for a candidate that would do X, and the candidate once elected does not X.
Does the very spirited primary between Senator Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson bother you in terms of defeating Tammy Baldwin, which is a goal of your party?
Well, yes, it does, and it depends upon how that primary turns out. Most important thing that has to be done is the party has to be kept together, regardless of who wins in August. And if the party is not kept together and the Democrats are united, as they are behind Senator Baldwin, then the nomination that will be decided by the voters on August 14th will end up being worthless. And there'll be a lot of good people that go down as a result of having the party faithful, or half the party faithful, being angry because their favorite candidate lost.
Now, this convention is about to make an endorsement. Mm-hmm. Mr. Nicholson is a newcomer. Senator Vukmir has been in the state Senate and the legislature. If Senator Vukmir gets the endorsement, should Mr. Nicholson consider withdrawing, Congressman?
Well, that's up to Mr. Nicholson to do that. I've never encouraged somebody to run or somebody to drop out during my entire political career. They have to view the positives and the negatives. And whenever somebody has asked me what to do, I say get a blank piece of paper out. Draw a line down the middle of the paper. Put a plus on one side and a minus on the other side, and make as long a list as you possibly can on both sides of that line. and then make a decision on whether you're going to do what you're thinking about or whether you're not going to do what you're thinking about. So if Mr. Nicholson ends up losing the endorsement today, I would encourage him to do that, because I think there's a future for him if he loses the endorsement in Republican politics. But how he conducts himself both after today and coming up to the primary is going to determine how bright that future is.
The March poll of Mr. Franklin had the governor's favorability at 47-40. About 12 or 14 Democrats are running against him. Are you concerned about Governor Walker's chances for a third term?
Well, Governor Walker has always been written off. He was written off in 10, he was written off in the recall in 12, he was written off in 14, and he's 3-for-3. What I think is good today is that he has come up with his positive program for what he wants to do in the next 4 years should he be reelected. And what voters, I think, are looking for is not so much of what you've done in the past, but also what you plan on doing if you're elected in the next term. And I think that Walker's plan for Wisconsin is positive, constructive, and forward-looking. And I hope that he really puts the pedal to the metal, because while the 14 Democrats or so are saying why they want to win the primary with 21%, Scott Walker can jump on in and said, I'm not opposed in the primary, and this is what I want to do for you, so vote for me in November.
Back to international relations. Do you support the president's decision to pull the United States from the Iran deal, sir?
Absolutely. The Iran deal was a bad deal, and Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, voted against it. And if it was bad 3 years ago, it's still bad. You know, Iran will have nuclear weapons in a few years under this deal. You know, it simply pushed back the time when Iran could legally get nuclear weapons until well after Barack Obama's term of office expired. That's not right. You know, presidents, when they deal with foreign policy, you know, ought to look in the future. You know, it's what Harry Truman did with the Marshall Plan and NATO and curtailing the Soviets in Europe. It's what Ronald Reagan did in revitalizing the economy. I think it's what George W. Bush did in terms of making America respected again, particularly in the Middle East.
You've been in the center of the debate over immigration for decades. Is it as intractable as ever?
Worse? It's worse.
Why is it worse?
Well, back in 1995, when I introduced a bill that dealt with border security, which passed the House on a bipartisan vote, and the sky fell down. You know, I even had the opposition to it Photoshop my head into a Nazi SS officer's uniform, which I thought got a little personal and over the line. But at that time, there was room for compromise and room for both sides to win something out of a compromise. That's not the case anymore. And it's now a case of one side winning and the other side losing. And everybody can go pick their side. And when you have a situation on a controversial and highly emotional issue like this, where there's no compromise, you end up getting deadlocked. Because people are scared of significant opposition, both in the primary and general election. And we've got interest groups in the country, and not just on immigration, but on practically everybody else, that like to be the ideological police, where if a left-wing group sees an incumbent not sufficiently progressive, they'll primary him. And the same thing with right-wing groups of people who don't think Republicans are sufficiently conservative. And, you know, the whole way our government was set up 230 years ago was to force compromise, checks and balances, people from different parts of the country expressing different viewpoints, a Senate and a House of Representatives. All of them were designed to force compromise. And compromise is something that people now fear when they serve in public office. And compromise was always tough before all of this polarization occurred. It's a lot more tough now to get accomplished.
Do you see any hope?
I don't see anything on immigration, you know, coming up. And, I had the idea of how to deal with the immigration problem. And there were a lot of left-wing groups that said, well, the Democrats are going to win the 2006 election, which they did, and we'll get a much better deal out of Pelosi. In 4 years as Speaker, Pelosi never brought an immigration bill up in the House of Representatives. The people who support doing something to keep the DACA kids in the country said, well, we've got to do this. Well, what happens is Trump was more generous to the DACA kids than Obama ever was, but he said that had to be tied with his border security plan. And Chuck Schumer and the Democrats, including Tammy Baldwin, stood on up and said it's more important that we stop Trump's border security plan than give relief to the DACA kids. I think that shows Republicans are for people and Democrats are for ideology.
Final question, if you're reelected, top priority in the next session, sir?
Top priority in the next session is to continue my efforts to deal with the opioid crisis. I have worked on the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act for 2.5 years. That was overwhelmingly passed and signed into law by President Obama in 2016. We need to fund it, and it includes law enforcement, medical treatment, counseling, education. It's the full nine yards on this. And we need to tweak the bill and update it so that we can get more money into more of these programs. The thing we need to do this year is that it is not illegal under federal law to traffic or buy fentanyl analogs, which are much more deadly than fentanyl, which is much more deadly than a natural opioid product like one of the oxy pills or heroin. The DEA has got a temporary regulation that expires in 2021. We ought to put that in law, you know, to make sure that as new fentanyl analogs are discovered, as well as the ones that are out there now, are illegal and classed as a class 2 narcotic, and we can go after the people that push their poison, you know, on our people. And it's not just kids, it's practically everybody. And when you hear that there are more people in Wisconsin and in America as a whole that have died of opioid overdoses than were killed in car crashes, this is a public health emergency. And we all better rise up and say that we don't know when it's going to happen in our family next, so we all better get involved in putting this public health emergency behind us.
Fifth District Congressman James Sensenbrenner.
Yeah, thank you.
Good to see you again,
thank
sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.